Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby. This is a countdown of the top 10 most popular episodes of 2025. Number 10 goes to Alicia Birch. Alicia explains a practical way to organize your day so you stay on track and avoid getting distracted or drifting into reactive work.
The main difference with me is there's a reason why I'm ringing everyone. There's always a I never do. You know when people get lists of candidates and they're just ringing? I don't do that. I have my day planned out in 15-minute increments, and everyone's got 15 minutes. It does run over. That's why I don't run it that militant. But the 15-minute increments are pre-planned from the day before. So that tonight, I'll sit here, you know, and I will go through everything that I need to do on Tuesday. I'm actually working this weekend, but everything I need to do on Tuesday, I'll be like, right, I know I need to speak to this person. And I'll list, there's 15-minute increments. And you think of how many 15 minutes we've got in a typical work day. I work from 8 till 8. So, because I'm doing both. So, yeah, think about how many people you've got to speak to then. That's a lot of people. Not everyone's going to answer the phone. Things will also change. I'll also get directed onto other stuff. But I break my day down militantly so that every person that I ring, I've got a reason for ringing them. It's whether to find out something about the business or anything that I found out that day will spur my business development for the next day.
Okay. Can you give any more examples? So one is, you know, a previous employer of someone that you, you know, that you're interviewing. What would be some other clues or leads that would spur your business development the next day?
So people leaving, unhappy people in general. I think that's a big one. New sites that are coming through. That's a big one for me. So I always go into one thing that we do for business development is we do our roundtable event, which I know we're going to touch on in a bit, but getting high-level people in the industry round the table, unfiltered, having good conversations. A lot of people really want to do that because I think that it's a fun thing to do and we all get really drunk and have a great time. But yeah, the round table events have been really great for us. Another thing that I do look out for, though, is redundancies. So anytime a business is potentially making any redundancies, we're the first people that just, we go straight, because we hear about things before they happen, which is great for us because it shows how well connected we are in the market. But then at the same time, it's actually protecting the people that are going to be affected by that to be able to say to them, look, like, don't, you know, we're not allowed to say that there's going to be redundancies, but we'll also give them the lifeline by saying, look, we're working on a few opportunities. Let me know if you're interested. Once those things happen, we then are able to get those people out and get them into other roles. That's always a big one for us. Company expansion, that's another one. Whenever we're working with businesses, we do project partners with them. So yeah, we just go through the whole company and see where our value is going to hold in the business and be able to actually offer solutions to things. So another thing that I do think is that when you are experienced in what you're doing and you're going in there confidently, you're able to actually suggest a solution that they've not thought of before. So we've been quite good at wrapping ourselves in these businesses and doing, look, we'll do it as a project. We'll hire six people. We'll do this. And it's worked very, very well for us.
Okay, I've made a note to circle back about asking about doing things as a project. So that's interesting. So I want to learn about your day plan, though. That's very meticulous. So
when my psychotic day plan.
No, it's good. It's good. What time of the day do you sit down and create your plan for the next day? And how long does that take?
Oh, God, it's not going to be a very good representation of running your own businesses, but probably around 9 o'clock at night. I'll decompress from the day. So say, for example, yesterday, I worked from 8 o'clock in the morning till 1 o'clock in the morning. And that was because I was just rammed with calls all day and night. It was an office-based day. I went out and had some dinner and then carried on till 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm okay with that. I'm obsessed with the job. So I love it. And I don't expect other people to do that. But my day plan is 9 o'clock at night. I'll look at my day. What have I done today? What's been good? What's been bad? That I worked with my business coach on that. So he said, he was like, you know, you need to do a bit of a close down and shut everything down. I'll then sit there and look at what information we've actually gained from the day, what things have happened, what rumors have we heard, what little, you know, tittles of information have we got. I will then sit down and look at, I structure my day into four quarters.
Yeah.
So I've got early morning, mid morning, early afternoon, mid-afternoon. Yeah. And that is because if I have a bad early morning, I've not got to have a bad mid-morning. it changes my mentality. So if I don't manage to achieve everything I want to in that early morning, I've still got three other quarters to smash the day. So I'm okay. You know, it's when you start getting to the third quarter, you're like, God, today's been a real shit show.
I like that. At number nine, Rachel Philby shows how one focused business development day per week can keep your pipeline flowing.
I always try and have one day. I kind of get into like the business development zone. So I'm kind of better when I just say, okay, I've done all my job work. So tomorrow I'm just going to focus on business development and I'll just do it for the whole day. But I won't be on the phone for the whole day, but I will be, you know, that's what my aim of the day will be around speaking to clients, whether it's past or future clients. And that'll be my day. And they're always my most favorite days.
So it's one day a week that is you're really focused on business development.
Yeah.
Okay. I like it. So just so we understand the structure of your business, how much is temp? How much is perm?
I now do about 80% perm, 20% temp. Temp covers my costs and keeps my business ticking over on the months that I'm not working.
Beautiful.
And then the rest is perm.
I love that model. That's great. What's your tech stack, Rachel?
So I have a wonderful CRM system, which I don't know if I'm allowed to give them a little plug.
Yeah, go for it.
A system called Firefish. It's a recruitment CRM system. Everything is automated on there. It has a brilliant ATS. It links to all, I write one advert on there and it fires across to all of my different, different job boards and things like that. So anyone who is setting up a recruitment business definitely a solo, but, you know, I'm sure they do big businesses as well, but small businesses, great system, very good system.
So shout out to Firefish then, based in Glasgow. And I used to work back in the day with Wendy McDougall, who's the CEO.
Yeah.
We are of a similar vintage and we worked at the same firm, and she was a huge biller as a recruiter and then set up her own recruiting firm and then set up her own software company. She's a cool, entrepreneur. So Firefish, any other software tools that you're using?
No. I'm old school. I use Firefish. I don't use it as much as I should. And I put everything on a spreadsheet because I'm old.
Okay. All right. Great. And then in terms of the perm roles that you're working, do you do retained or is it contingent? And that you've already said it's all exclusive, but do you get money up front?
I don't actually, only because I'm sure I would if I asked. But my roles, you know, my kind of general salaries I'm dealing with is anything from about, 28K up to about 70K. So it's that kind of mid manager kind of market. And it moves quickly. So those types of roles you're aiming to fill within a month anyway. So I really do push for exclusivity because I need to be sure that if I'm going to put my hours into the job, I'm going to obviously be paid.
Totally.
So, but I don't actually ever feel the need to ask for the retainer because from a billing perspective, by the time I've billed and they've paid the retainer, I've probably billed the perm fee.
You would have filled it already. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's the speed of the market.
Got it. What's your one or two sentences to request or confirm that they're happy to work with you on a exclusive basis?
So I first of all, I guess I explain that I only do. So I take the whole, it's right at the end of the call.
Yeah.
So I take the whole kind of job brief and explain what I can do and, all of that kind of stuff. And then I would say to them, I only typically work roles exclusive. If I say that I'm going to work it, it's my kind of intent that I can definitely fill this role. I'll put everything into it. I already have the candidates, things like that. And we can review throughout the process because obviously if I don't produce the goods, then of course I can't hold them to it forever. But I guess my hope and my expectation would be that off the back of the initial call, the meeting, and that they would feel confident that I can fill the job and they'd want to partner with me as an agency to recruit the role. Touch wood, I don't get too much pushback on it, to be honest.
From business development We shift to positioning. At number 8, Carol Wenham talks about how to introduce a retain service in a way that helps clients understand the value.
You know, first we discuss urgency. You know, how urgent is it to fill the search? And then we talk about how difficult is it going to be to find the person they want and move them to podunk in the middle of nowhere, USA. right. And then we talk about what else have you tried to do to fill the search and how have your efforts gone with that, which leads to the urgency piece. And then when they've checked all three of those boxes, they're like, oh yeah, retain makes sense in this case.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't go there. And I will say, fine, look, you know, you can have a half a step down from this, you know, the stepchild, if you will, and we can look at an engaged, here's what you're trading off. You won't get quite as much urgency and response. And you're not going to get quite as much exclusivity because we're not necessarily going to push candidates to your search first. But you will get something much better than contingency, which I think is what you need. Now, when they hear what they're not getting, they don't like that, right?
Yes.
And so they tend to default back. And then I say to them, well, before you make the decision, let me send you a sample of a position prospectus.
Right.
Because this comes standard with our retained search. And if you agree that this is going to be a tremendous value add because this search is going to be difficult, then I think you'll see that retained is the right option. And 90% of the time, if I can't win it on the initial call, when I go to the follow-up call after they've seen the position prospectus, they almost always revert to a retained.
Brilliant, Carol. I love that. That's really, you're giving us a masterclass here. So thank you for that. That's really good.
You know, I will share with you, Mark, and this is my vulnerable side. Before I started moving into retained search, the owner of our firm, Bruce Whitaker, for years beat me over the head with, Carol, why are you spending all of your time doing contingency? You really should be a retained recruiter. And I had this serious, I'm not worthy issue that retained was up here and I didn't see myself here, right? And that's an inner perception that I think many of us struggle with, especially people who want to go from contingency to retain. It's like, why all of a sudden am I good enough to do retain? And so what solved that problem for me was understanding not what was changing in me, but what was changing in the service that I was providing. You know, how did I justify the difference between what I was doing in contingency versus what I was doing in retain? And it dawned on me that I was providing retained search at a contingency price.
Aha, uh-huh. Yes, and I was absolutely.
Like, you have to stop doing this, Carol.
Right.
And that's when the aha moment hit. That's when the light bulb went on. And I was like, no, people really will pay more for what you're doing on contingency. And so stop doing all of that on contingency. And that was the aha moment for me.
That's brilliant. I love that you shared that. And so the aha light bulb moment, I think absolutely, you know you're ready to make that shift if you find that or you feel like you're already delivering a retained quality of service, but you're just not getting paid for it, then why are you doing that, right? Let's draw a distinction between if you want this level, then this is what it takes. Did you have a different fee percentage for those different tiers or?
We did not.
Yeah, I didn't either. And I think now I have I've seen it work three ways. And I'd like your take on this. So the way I did it was the fee percentage is the same. The only difference is the way the payment is structured, but you're getting all this more value. So why wouldn't you do that, right? You're getting more value.
That's exactly what we said. We said, look, the price is the same. You're going to end up paying the exact same amount no matter which option you choose. The only difference is your cash flow.
Right.
So if it makes sense to you from a cash flow, why wouldn't you do all these other things if it's going to cost the exact same thing anyway?
Okay. From positioning, we come back to pipeline. At number 7, Stuart Barnes walks us through his three Bucket BD model, a simple, reliable way to organize your outreach.
I like to have like three buckets in terms of business development. So I think there's like your initial leads, so short-term wins. So this would be hot leads in the market where you know a company's hiring and there's a call to action on that. And there's a specific sort of cadence follow-up that we use on our hot leads where we follow up on that. Then there's like the key account side of it, which is pretty self-explanatory, is basically massaging key accounts and keeping front and center with companies we've got terms with, so that when they are releasing jobs to an agency where, you know, your Navitas are being considered. And then I think there is the final step of it, which is more the medium term, long term relationship building, which I think is the area that people struggle with the most. So I think that is identifying. I mean, the number I look at is 300. So I say to everyone, 300 managers. You need 300 hiring managers in your database as a minimum. And your aim is to identify out of those 300 who are going to be the medium to long term hirers in your market. And obviously, there's a number of questions you can ask on the BD call to ascertain that in the first BD call. But it's am I going to stay in contact with this person on a monthly basis? And typically, I think it's what, 6 to 8 times that they say don't they before people buy sometimes. I think people give up before then.
Yeah.
So my philosophy on it is, and I say to everyone, is these 300 managers will hire at least one person this year. So if you take that, 300 people are going to hire someone in their team. Are they going to hire it through you, another agency, directly or through referrals or some different way? But if they are going to hire it for an agency, then we need to be sort of front and center of that. And therefore, we need to, you know, maintain that relationship with them. And that involves calling them up every month, following up on previous conversations, talking about industry news, doing things like just calling them up about a candidate that you're working with at the moment, and just engaging them so that they're sort of, you know, brain functions when they get a job. If they think of an agency, they're going to go to your agency first of all. And I think that's, in this day and age, the generation of today like things immediately. They like that, you know, I refer to it as sort of the Klarna culture where I can pretty much buy most things straight away. You know, when I started in recruitment, if I wanted to buy a nice suit, because you wore suits to work then, you would have to physically have the money in your bank account to go and do that. Now you can just stick it on Klarna and get it, right? So that there is that in this day and age, you can get things quicker and people want things quicker, but building relationships isn't going to happen straight away. And that's about maintaining, a cadence over a number of months, six to 8 months to a year, to then, you know, build that relationship, because then the client will think, oh, okay, this person is following up me and is repeatedly in my line of vision. So yeah, I will naturally, if I'm looking to hire, I will go to them. So that's the way I would see BD and how we do the BD strategy. And I look for everyone to have those three buckets, applying a certain percentage of their time in BD to each of those areas.
This is brilliant. Thanks for sharing that, Stuart. I think really useful. So they need a minimum of 300 hiring managers that they have added to the database. And they're reaching out to them monthly. Is that the idea? So that you mentioned the 6 to 8 touch points. So over the course of 6 to 12 months, hopefully they're going to start to get some opportunities with those hiring managers. And then over time, that can really snowball. And then those turn into the key accounts that then you're trying to maximize. And is it mainly just a telephone outreach, or what channels are you using in order to do your business development?
Yeah, I think this is obviously becoming more and more prominent that, you know, these days. Yeah, the telephone is number one, always is. But I think Microsoft Teams for video meetings. So we'll just put Microsoft Teams invites into people's diaries. So just put it straight in a diary. I'd say at least 50% will accept it, and then you just jump on a meeting with them.
Let's talk about this, because this is a controversial one, Stuart. And I've seen various LinkedIn posts about, like, if one more person, like, invites me to a, you know, to a Teams or a Google meeting or a Zoom meeting unsolicited, then, you know, so what's your philosophy on that, and what's the success rate that you're finding?
So that's the key to it. You wouldn't do it unsolicited. I think unsolicited is creating starting the relationship off not in the right way. I think as long as there's been a BD call, then I think at that point it's fine to do. But I wouldn't unless obviously it's been sort of discussed or set up. But yeah, we wouldn't do it unsolicited, but we do use that a lot as a call to action. So, you know, in general on processes or anything like that, we'll just send a Teams meeting to whoever it is. And the great thing about that is you'll get a response. So if I just email a hiring manager asking for something, i.e. feedback or decision or, you know, some advice on something, they don't have to reply to that. But for whatever reason, if you stick a diary invite, a Teams meeting in for later that day or tomorrow with, I don't know, feedback on resumes, if they don't accept it, they will action it.
Okay, so I totally get it if you're in process, right? That makes a lot of sense. But explain to me how you would use it in a BD context in a way that that the client is going to accept.
So that would be typically you've spoke to them at least once,
okay,
maybe a couple of times, and you want to get face-to-face contact with them. Because obviously, as we know, if you get face-to-face contact with someone, you can build a better relationship with it.
Yes.
So I think it's taking the relationship to the next level.
Okay.
And because we, you know, maybe you've done a couple of phone calls with them, then that's a good opportunity to then to be able to do that. And because you've spoke with them a couple of times and they know who you are, they'll either accept it, or if they don't accept it, they'll suggest, let's catch up, in 2 months or whatever. And largely people are pretty receptive to it. We don't really have massive kickback I can't remember anybody that's said to us, stop, as you said there. So I think maybe the context of how people are using it, if you just send it out the blue and you've not spoke to the person before, I think that's probably where you might run into some issues.
That makes sense. I can see it being super useful where, like, often one of the outcomes, if you're calling someone and they don't have an immediate need, then, you know, different possible outcomes. You might ask for referrals or, you know, more information about the business or future plans. But ultimately, you're probably going to ask to, like, you're going to get some kind of a commitment to call them back again, right? So I think in that context, it makes a lot of sense because, you know, if they say, oh, call me in 3 months, right? And you're like, okay, well, you know, why don't we talk? And then you're going to propose an earlier time than that, because 3 months, anything can happen, right? That's too
far. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're going to try and negotiate a sooner check-in. But coming off that call, I can totally see it making sense to send them the invite with a specific time because it's fresh in their mind and they, you know, then. But would there be a situation where you would just send it out of the blue to someone who you had spoken to in the past? Or?
Yeah. If we want to get hold of someone, 100%.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so.
So in other words, you're calling, but they're not, you know, you haven't been able to reach them. Let's just send them the calendar invite. Is that the idea? Or?
Yeah. I think if you're on a monthly cadence with someone, and the reason why we do monthly, Mark, is, as you said, you know, things can change quite quickly. Hiring processes take 4 to 6 weeks. If you're not following up with someone that regularly, they could easily start a process, probably hired someone by the time you next catch up with them, and the previous time you spoke with them, they might not be hiring at all. But certainly in the US market, where it's 2 week notice, if someone hands a notice in and they need to replace that person quickly, then off they go, so to speak. So I think, yeah, that that that's sort of the sort of how he would do things. And I think that's also a testament to, if people do accept that, what's the quality of your first calls been like? Because if they sort of go, who are you? Then obviously they don't remember the calls or whatever. So I think that's what we try and get across.
How much tribal knowledge is getting lost in your business every single day? Your recruiters are having conversations with. If you've ever wanted to reach out to a client or a candidate but couldn't find their email address or phone number, listen up. Recruiter Flow is an AI-first ATS and CRM with built-in data enrichment. You're on someone's LinkedIn profile, and with their Chrome extension, you can instantly find their email address and phone number. No switching between tools, no paying for multiple data providers. Plus, you can set up email aliases to protect your primary domain when you're doing outreach, something every recruiter should be thinking about for email deliverability. And here's the best part. It's all included in the platform. No add-ons, no surprises, just integrated tools that help you work faster and smarter. To see it in action, book a demo at recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. If your pipeline depends on referrals and repeat business, then you're one market shift away from disaster. Trust me, I've been there. But there's a better way to win new clients, a smarter way, one that gives you control. I've created a free masterclass that shows you how. Inside, you'll discover a proven 9-step system used by over 800 recruitment business owners to land retained work at premium fees, with clients who treat them like trusted advisors and not just another vendor. If you're serious about growing your business and reclaiming your time, this is your next step. Register now at recruitmentcoach.com/clients. Clients and candidates that contain valuable intelligence, salary expectations, relocation preferences, company expansions, hiring plans. But if you're lucky, they write 3 lines of notes after the call. Most of the information disappears forever. Recruiter Flow is an AI-first ATS and CRM with built-in note-taking that captures those conversations, transcribes them, and automatically structures the data into your system. Now you can search across months of conversations, synthesize insights before client meetings, and actually leverage all of that knowledge your team is gathering. Several of our Recruitment Coach clients are using this feature, and the results speak for themselves. To learn more, book a demo at recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. From business development models, we shift to success habits. At number 6, Jenny Diaz brings us back to basics. She explains how a clear daily plan can help you stay focused and super productive.
Tell me your planning process.
Sure. So I have this Microsoft Word doc. It's nothing special, but it has every hour 8 a.m. to 6 a.m. I don't always start at 8. I don't always end at 6, but gives me some flexibility. And it has half hour increments. I print it out. I take a pencil because the day will change. And I write down whatever's on my Microsoft calendar. I have a list of follow-ups that I'm going to follow up with. That's usually like 5 to 30 people, depending. I have my 3 main goals. I have my 2 jobs I'm going to work that day. I get it. I have things I'm grateful for that I've learned. I have my long-term goals. I have all these things like on a different side of the paper, my references I need to take, and some other notes. And this is just, it's just a Microsoft doc that's evolved. But I fill all that out first. And then I look at it and then I say, okay, what do I need to do for my day? And then I just fill it out in pencil. The phone rings, I erase something and rework it as the day progresses. So that's it.
That is awesome. Really, really like that. And so it sounds like this is something that you've kind of created and evolved over time. Like mm-hmm. the sections, I don't think the Hayes Day Plan had like, what am I grateful for on it?
No.
Right?
No.
I think
I don't always fill it out, and that's on me. But
yeah. I love that. And so you write this out every day?
90% of days.
That's awesome. You know, we used to say that if you do your day plan once out of 5 days, you're going to be performing at 20%. If you fill it out 3 times a week, you're going to be performing at 60%, right? And so it's 90% is great. Not many people get that.
There have been times where I've lost it for several months, but when I come back, like there is instant just focus. So yeah.
Focus is the superpower that mm-hmm. all recruiters need, for sure. It's something I need. It's my Achilles heel. I'm scattered and almost ADHD pursuing lots of different ideas. So explain to me why it's important to write it out as opposed to why not just type it onto the Word doc or use like Outlook calendar or whatever.
Yeah. So short is it doesn't work for me if I do it on a computer. I think that's old school. And I also think, again, I read this book years ago, the first one I read in recruiting, that was, you need to write it out. So I just took it. But I have tried doing it digitally and failed. And I find, and I actually put a LinkedIn post the other day about this, I always have 17,000 tabs open. And you know, I don't know what all the things are on a computer. I don't know all the names, but I just know there's so many things open on my computer. I am distracted all day, but if I look down, which I do constantly, and see something that's always there, makes a huge difference. And I can't make that happen on a computer. I also think, and I think it's true for me, if I write it down and I have a little bit more physical effort into making the plan, I'm more like, I'm doing this.
You're more committed because you...
I'm more committed. That's the word. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes total sense. I get that. Awesome. And I like the different sections you had as well, follow-ups, reference checks, which jobs I'm going to work. But explain to me, why are you working two jobs a day? Is that what, that sounds like a lot.
Yeah, so usually there's two. It's blank, so I might just write one. I'm typically write two, and realistically, I usually work one.
Okay.
But I guess it's something I learned. Somebody told me, I'm not that creative, I suppose, but somebody told me like you can at most work two jobs a day.
Sure.
So I write those like the definite and the maybes.
Okay. That makes sense. I mean, I guess someone who's in a delivery role could work like one in the morning, one in the afternoon or something.
Right.
But I feel like if you're 360.
It's challenging. Yeah.
Yeah.
I rarely get to. I forgot. I also have a submittal section. That's important.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Are there any other sections you've not told us?
This is from memory. So thankful. There's a thankful for and a thankful to section. So I also don't usually fill that out. But like people, I really should say thank you to because I need to remember that. But I don't always.
From planning your day, we zoom out to the bigger picture. At number five, Didi Doak offers a well-informed perspective on the broader trends affecting the recruitment industry and what they may mean for agency owners. What's your take on that as someone who is, obviously you're the champion of the UK recruitment business, but you have, you know, affiliation to the US as well. What's your, and of course there's been over the last decade, there've been a movement of the bigger recruiting firms kind of landing and expanding in the U.S. as well. But do you think that trend's going to continue or have we maxed out on that?
I think we're seeing right now the bigger firms kind of retracting.
Okay.
I don't know precisely if they're going to contract in the U.S., but I kind of suspect they are. Okay. I think it will be very interesting to see what happens to the operations that the big ones have in, say, Houston, where it's a big oil town. Yeah. What will happen with, clean energy in that environment? Right. Because, as you know, the U.S. position right now is drill, baby, drill.
Right. Yes.
So that may be one place in the world where... not the old technology, but the traditional ones still can play very strongly in the market.
Absolutely.
I think one thing, though, that sets the UK apart from the US in the recruitment and staffing market, there is so much innovation here.
There's so much innovation.
Innovation, yes. Now, when there is an innovator in the U.S., we hear about it and they usually come over. When there were really big job boards.
Yep.
There were a couple that were really big there and they came here.
Yes.
And they're still kind of here, but they're not the giants on the marketplace that they were. But many recruitment agencies here want to be innovative. They may not be that big. They may not have all that turnover, but they want to do things in a way that's going to help them stand out. maybe you can thank the saturation for that. American companies, they are innovating, but it's this is a personal feeling, but it's always so much about scale. You know, this is the biggest, or this is the, you know, the largest and so forth. And here, those numbers are so important, but at the same time, it's about, well, we do things a little differently here, you know?
Okay. That's interesting because you think, I mean, America is number one in terms of innovation in science, technology, medicine, and,
for the
you know,
time being.
And, but I hear what you're saying in terms of the, there is a real need to differentiate here. And if you pair that with developments in artificial intelligence, I think there's just this feeling like we have to like evolve and, you know, incorporate AI into what we're doing, the way we're working, and both to increase efficiency and productivity, but also to differentiate from the competitors, because, you know, and I think the saturation then drives, you know, the, you know, puts more price pressure because the client has then the perception, well, it's all the same thing, so I'm going to go with the cheapest.
Yes.
So you have to counteract that by constantly finding ways to, how can we not just say that we're different, because it's easy to say, but how can you demonstrate that you have tangible differentiators that will result in real client benefits? And so that's maybe part of it. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that very much is a part of it. And I think the start of course, the U.S. has a gigundo startup culture.
Yeah.
But in the U.K., startups are, people don't want to do something in a traditional way, and they want to have their own businesses. And that's a driver too. I'm very keen at the moment to get some information, to get some insight that I don't currently have about scale-ups.
Yeah. Tell me more about that.
Well, I don't know a lot to tell you.
Why are you curious about that particularly?
Because I think we all know many ways to start up a recruitment company. You know, that's it's been handed down through the ages in a lot of ways. But once you've got that company, how do you take it bigger if you want to make it bigger? Or how do you make it more viable even? I think viable may be the word for it, because you can go along for a few years and, you know, cover your costs and so forth. But taking that jump to this is a viable business.
Yes. From industry trends, we move back to structure and process. At number four, Jessica Hamilton shares how systems help you scale with more confidence.
I've always and still think placements are symptomatic of a system you've got behind it. Placements, my old boss used to make fun of me because I care about placements. Of course I do. But I almost lose interest after the second stage. Like, they're done. They're going to make money. I need to go and fill the funnel back up, or I need to go and do something else. That's just a management piece at that point. So if you keep your eye on placements also, you forget that the placement is the prize. It's not the program.
Can you repeat that? The placement is the prize, not the program?
Yeah.
There's a lot of alliteration there. I think you might have just coined a phrase.
Maybe. You see it on a t-shirt one.
But could you explain that a little more?
What I mean is that, like, most salespeople I know can tell you about their numbers, and most salespeople can tell you about their pipeline. But when they talk to you about their pipeline, they talk about the other end of it, or their funnel. They talk about what wins are coming through. I don't think it's relevant at all, but I think that if you're constantly filling it up, and by filling it up, I'm not just talking about interviews, I'm talking about marketing, BD, meetings, establishing yourself as an expert, doing panels, doing podcasts, doing all sorts of other really cool stuff, your funnel is way further back than people realize, the program, and then it filters through. So if you're focused over here and all your time and energy is going here, well, then we see it all the time with sort of, you know, the juniorish billers where the inconsistency comes through.
Yes. Okay, great. Let's talk about that top of funnel marketing and BD effort then, since that's something that is your forte. You're obviously really good at it. And so, in fact, let me just refer to my notes here. You talk about the art of the soft sell. Can you say a little more about that?
I think.
You have a lot of great phrases, by the way, Jess.
Lay awake at night, thinking of them. So I truly believe people don't like to know they're being sold to. And the best analogy I can give is when you go into a clothes shop and people are all over you. It's really annoying. But if you're walking around the other day, they were like, oh my God, I just bought that top. It's so cool, the pair of jeans. You're like, oh, is it? It becomes like a credibility issue. So the soft sell comes from, for me, and it needs to lean into your personality style, right? And I'm not saying the hard sell doesn't work, because I've worked with some really like punchy recruiters and they're super successful. But for me and Fink Select, we're very relationship led. Even our temp side of the business, which is hugely successful, isn't like a temp desk. It's really relationship led. So most of our work comes through referrals. Most of it comes inbound off LinkedIn or people approaching us. And that comes because we're credibility led versus recruitment led. So you'll see me posting all the time on LinkedIn about like how to recruit. I did this week. How do you recruit a search for you on LinkedIn if you're in financial crime? And I showed them the screenshots.
I saw that. That post absolutely blew up. Over 300 engagements. How many impressions did that get?
That got about 40,000 impressions in a couple of days, which is, you know, and that's what I mean is all of those people have now seen, oh, Jess cares about her candidates. She really understands that this is a pain point for them. And it's a genuine, authentic thing because there's so many people out of work. We've got a lot of redundancies at the moment in London. Or I'll post, today I posted about some financial crime internships that are going with clients of ours, Apply Direct. We do post our jobs and we do post obviously relevant stuff, but you can't just rely on that, I don't think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I love this. So talk to me more about becoming a thought leader in your industry and becoming known as like the go-to person. You committed very early on to posting on LinkedIn. That's something we teach our coaching clients. But it sounds like you've been doing that for years.
It's a game changer. It is a game changer. The amount of people who know me because of LinkedIn and don't necessarily know me is phenomenal. Like I went to a networking event or I was speaking on a panel a few weeks ago. And so many people were coming up going, you're from LinkedIn.
Yes, you're from LinkedIn.
But what more could a business owner or a salesperson want? People coming to you to introduce themselves to say, hey, I've seen you on LinkedIn. You know, there's a fine line as well, I think, between LinkedIn and posting and impressions and how you kind of do it. Some people lean into the videos, which I think is really cool. I just don't have the confidence to do it yet. Or the tech, it just really needs to be whatever you do online needs to really resonate with you as a person. Because when people see you, I'm really casual and quite giggly as a person, and my posts reflect that. I write like I talk. You must write like you talk on LinkedIn, because otherwise people, one, it goes back to they don't like to be told that they've been sold to. So if you are writing like, I've got a great new product, people scroll past. They have no interest. But if it resonates with them, like I was talking with a client the other day, people go, and they read. So there is an art form to the medium that you're posting on. And you've got to have some respect for the fact that it's LinkedIn and not Facebook. And it's also not a business journal.
Yes. Okay. So write like you talk. There's one golden nugget straight away that people should be taking note of, because that is absolutely fantastic advice. From support systems, we move back to relationships. At number three, Brandon Glick explains how consistent relationship building compounds year after year to create a referral-based business.
It was interesting. Like when we first started doing it, I was trying to find the silver bullet. So for 1 week, it was connection requests with a follow-up, couple follow-ups, just trying to get a get-to-know-you call. Then it was, you know, we never did reverse marketing. It was a little bit of reverse marketing, little success, you know, kind of hit or miss. And then it was, trying to get people in our network to make, you know, more introductions for us more directly. And there's several different things, or like reaching out to startups that got funding and different things. And what we've realized is it's not one of these things. Like it's all of these things. It's these 3, 4, 5 things. It's still Correct. Tapping your network, but yes. then doing it every single week. And the difficulty has always been, well, my team is delivering. They're working really hard sourcing great candidates. They're working really hard building account relationships. How do they build that into their day-to-day? Yeah. So part of what we've done, and it's very low-key, but effectively, like we have an account manager. So in our team, an account manager is mostly handling the client relationship and should be starting to get into some business development. Like we now have them picking a lane. So it could be manufacturing, could be GovCon, could be, one of the areas we have a substantial client base. And they're just reaching out to 100 people a week or trying to connect with 100 people a week. You know, maybe they're connecting with 40 or 50 of them and then just sending really tailored follow-up. Yeah. And it's not rocket science. It's nothing crazy. But when you compound it and you look at the business we're building, if an account manager already has some good accounts and they're adding another 3-4 a year, they go from a 250K book to a 400 or 500K book very quickly, with just a little bit of added consistency. So again, it's like, we're always trying to find the silver bullet, but there really isn't. It's just compound. How do you compound your relationships over time?
Brendan, this is 100%. I agree. I think it's human nature. We want the silver bullet. Like, just tell me one thing. And people ask me all the time, like, just, I know there's all these tools and there's lots of different, strategies and things they could do, but what's the one thing that I should do?
Yeah.
And that's going to bring in the most business. And as you said, well, you need to do a variety of things consistently over time to get that compound effect. Definitely. Because you can't, like, by the way, you use the term reverse marketing, which is super interesting because I've only ever heard Australians use that term. Most Americans call it NPC marketing, most placeable candidate marketing, I think is what you're talking about, where you have a candidate that you represent.
Yes, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Reverse marketing sounds a little better.
It sounds cool. All right. So reverse marketing, you've got the LinkedIn outreach, you've got like 3 or 4 or 5 different things.
Yes.
And you get a little bit from all of those things, then that like together gives you enough new business, those new 3-4 accounts a year.
Definitely.
Right.
I do think when you're in that mindset, I'm sorry to cut you off, but
that's okay.
Like when you're in that mindset, it puts you in a mindset where I'm already doing business development that's hard. Why don't I do the business development that's easy and start reaching out to the people I know that I see post a job or, just got promoted to VP.
Yeah.
Like I think it's very so easy as a recruiter to just be heads down trying to close placements and you lose touch of, wait, I have a lot of opportunity around me that I'm not really taking advantage of.
Shifting now from relationships to resilience. At number 2, Carolina Willis shares how she worked through an extremely tough period and returned with more purpose, more clarity, and drive.
So it was difficult at the beginning. Really tons of work, working hours, long working hours, small children. They wanted mommy all the time. And it was a really difficult to the point where I wanted to give up. The first time in my career, I said, I cannot do it.
Okay. Wow. At what point was this, Carolina? So
the first year, I started in 2023, beginning like January, because at the end of 2022, that was my idea, kind of slowly stepping down from my other company and going solo. And the 2023 was, that was a rough one. Really, having a few months without paychecks, that was tough. And I was in a dark room many times.
And so what was going through your head at that point where you're feeling like, I don't know if I can do this? That it does, because it sounds like you don't know, you hadn't really suffered from any self-doubt up until this point. And so that must have been quite a shock.
Yeah, the tons of work I had to do and being a mom. So I had two full-time jobs, sleepless nights, couldn't work. I worked all day, couldn't sleep all night. So it was to the point where I was breaking down. And I said, I cannot do this. And again, Anthony came to me and said, you can. You've done it for a long time. You got this. And I said, yes, I'm a soldier. I am not going to give up. This is an opportunity. My girls will be proud of their mom. And I have to do it for other people. I want to show them I can do it. I need to bring these other people from outside of America and fulfill their American dream. And that was my purpose. Again, helping people. And I love this business. It's all about relationship, all about helping. And that's what I didn't give up.
Carolina, so the period where you were really at the breaking point, how long did that last for, and what impact did that have in terms of like emotionally and your family and everything?
Yeah, I had a mental breakdown. I was in a stage where, you know, I had to be picked up. I did reach out to you, I remember, beginning of 2024, but then I didn't have the funds. I was like, you know, we were using all our savings because we had to still invest in the business and pay our mortgage and still survive. We had two little children. And it took me some time since I reached out to you.
And so it sounds like Anthony was a huge rock for you. And you are a very resilient person, but there must be more to the story than that. Like, how did you pick yourself back up and find this sort of, where did that come from to be able to keep going?
First of all, we left Florida. We moved to South Carolina. And that was the point, I think the heat here was too hot. I was giving up. It was just nonstop hot. And I felt that I need to change. I need to make changes. If I'm not happy, I need to make change. The same what I did in UK, I did in Dubai. If I'm not happy with something, I make changes. I go for it. I take risk in life, and I don't want to regret something I could have done. And so we moved, so that start fresh. And that brought me like a fresh air into my head, really a new environment. New ideas, and totally told myself I can do it.
Love it. Okay, so let's talk about, now you have a wealth of experience in healthcare recruiting, and you've seen it done in different countries in the UK, in the Middle East, and now you knew how to make it work in the States. So what changes did you make? How did you approach the marketplace differently in order to adapt to working in America?
Definitely, the business development here is different. So I started cold calling. Back when I started in UK, I didn't have any AIs or systems. It was just phone and phone book, and we had to go for the client. So here the same. I was just cold calling, emailing, attending conferences, just show myself in person. That helped a lot. Conferences. Joining associations, really getting out there to show my presence.
Imagine this. You're no longer chasing clients. You're working with people who respect you, pay your full fee, and treat you like a trusted advisor. You've got a system that fills your pipeline even when you're busy delivering. That's exactly what the Client Acquisition Accelerator is designed to do. And I've created a free training to show you the 9 steps that over 800 recruitment business owners have used to build predictable revenue, win retained searches, and finally scale without burning out. You don't need to hustle harder. You need a better system. Register now at recruitmentcoach.com/clients. And that brings us to number 1, the single most listened to episode of the year, was Richard Vanderblom. Richard explained why your LinkedIn reach has dropped and how focusing on relevance helps you get better results from your LinkedIn content. Could you maybe speak a little bit about the decrease in organic reach, and then we'll pull out some more insights after that?
Yeah, I think it's spot on to talk about this. And also that you say that the Insights report confirmed some of the things you saw. And that always gives me the feeling that we're on the right track. The more people say, hey, this confirms or this explains, or now I feel more relaxed because it's not just me. Because
right.
In all honesty, it can be very frustrating. I've had content-wise, not business-wise, but content-wise, I've myself had a very frustrating year on LinkedIn. Because just like you, I know my content is spot on. I've grew my followers over 200,000. So I should have more and more reach. And right. I'm on minus 60% myself. So that's huge. So what we discovered, and although LinkedIn doesn't communicate a lot about the LinkedIn algorithm, they did communicate last year around this time, it was May, June, when their head of product development said that LinkedIn was going to tweak the algorithm to discourage people from going viral, but to empower people to create more impact. And they literally said, that means we're going to show your post to less people, but to more relevant people. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that our research confirmed, because on general, like in general, 95% of people on LinkedIn have witnessed a severe decrease in reach. There are always people that go, Richard, I don't recognize it because my content has never performed better. Well, you know, there are always 5% that do things differently, or maybe they have a bit of a push in the back by the LinkedIn. I don't know, but 95%, so the majority, have seen a decrease in reach that varies from minus 35 to even minus 70%. On the same hand, a lot of those people have more or less, including myself, the same engagement. So much less reach, but still the same number of likes, comment, repost. And that would actually prove that LinkedIn has actually tweaked the algorithm to get less reach, but by showing it to more relevant audience, still get a fair high number of engagement, because when it's more relevant, people tend to comment more early or tend to repost your content. It has become more difficult to get big numbers of reach. It also, follower growth has slowed down substantially. I think, and I really would like to emphasize, it's not about reach. It starts with engagement. It starts with how many conversations you get based on your content. And eventually, it starts with how many relevant incoming invites, incoming messages, and conversion signals you get from LinkedIn. But reach definitely has gone down. Organic reach, definitely.
Yes. Okay, so that's super interesting. I think your report said, like, on average, it's declined by 50%. But then you emphasize this point of relevance over reach. So knowing that that is an intentional change that LinkedIn are making, what does that mean for creators who, you know, are you saying that, well, first of all, it's reassuring to know that it's not just me and it's not just individuals, but that's affected even everyone, including you. But are you saying that because the content, maybe LinkedIn has refined its distribution so that it's showing it to less people, but more relevant people? Like, what is the real impact of that for us as creators and as business people? And are there any changes to our, you know, strategy or behavior that we need to make to adjust to that?
Yeah, I think there are a few things we need to consider. First of all, it has become more and more important that before you publish your post on LinkedIn, you need to ask yourself, what is my primary goal of this post? Let me give you an example. If I want to increase my visibility amongst the network that already knows me, so I'm talking first degree connection, I'm talking followers, personal storytelling posts where I share experience, maybe included with a video or a selfie, perform really well. Because the algorithm now is trained on whenever you share something personal, LinkedIn mainly shows it to a network that already knows you. So the increase outside your bubble is almost none. Okay, so that's why you get a lot of engagement on personal stories, because people already know you and it resonates with them. If I want to have impact or more reach outside my bubble, I need to go to educational content. Whenever I go to educational content where I share, let's talk in terms of recruitment. So if I share 4 tips how to get hired in 2025, that's educational content, which the algorithm of LinkedIn is trained to push beyond the boundaries of your network. So you see on those kind of posts that you get less engagement, but you get more reach because it travels outside your bubble. If you have conversion as your primary goal, and in the world of recruiters, that could, for example, be I'm creating a post, I'm sharing a link to a job posting on my website. So you have an external link. And we all know that that reduces reach, but my conversion maybe is not reach. My goal is to get people to click on the link to watch the job posting, maybe to, you know, apply for a job. So that means that every now and then having external links, if your goal is conversion, is absolutely spot on. To give you an example, this last week I created an infographic that had 60,000 views, which is above average because it was educational. And I saw that a majority of engagement came from outside my network, secondary connections. Later this week, I shared a post with a link because my goal was conversion. I wanted people to check a link and to check if this was something that they would love to have. And I only got 6,000 views, which is like, it's like 15% of my infographic. However, I got massive conversion. I got massive, like I reached my goal. So I think reach should not be the central point of our content strategy. It should be, what is my goal? And based on your goal, you adapt the format of the content, the length of the content, and also the visuals or the type of content you want to share. That's the most important thing.
Thank you for joining me for this year's Top 10. I hope these insights give you something useful as you plan for the year ahead. The best Christmas present you can get me this year is to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite platform, Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. And if you're already a subscriber, then please do take a moment and leave me a review. That would mean the world to me. I wish you and your family a happy and healthy holiday season. I've got lots of excellent content coming soon, and I want to support you in making 2026 your best year yet. Happy New Year!